I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
In a highly unusual speech at Georgetown University today, CIA Director George Tenet went public with his thoughts about the quality of pre-war intelligence on Iraq. Tenet said CIA intelligence analysts differed on the state of Iraq's weapons programs in a report given to the White House in 2002. But, he added,
they never said there was an imminent threat. Rather, they painted an objective assessment for our policymakers of a brutal dictator who is continuing his efforts to deceive and build programs that might constantly surprise us and threaten our interests.
Tenet repeatedly stressed that no one told agents what to say or how to say it, and that their disagreements were made known to the administration. And he said discussions about intelligence, especially when it came to Iraq, must not be politicized.
Because the alternative, politicized, haphazard evaluation without the benefit of time and facts, may well result in an intelligence community that is damaged and a country that is more at risk.
Tenet's speech comes as President Bush prepares to name a commission to investigate intelligence failures and as senators meet to review their own classified investigations of intelligence failures. Well, joining us on the line is Walter Pincus. He covers national security affairs for The Washington Post. And, Walter, just a little context. Britain is preparing to investigate the quality of its intelligence. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld reiterated his belief yesterday that WMDs will be found, despite what Arms Inspector David Kaye says. So why Tenet's speech now?
Well, I think it comes after probably David Kaye's original interviews and his appearance before Capitol Hill saying that the intelligence community ought to apologize to the president for misleading him. That and the fact that the Senate committee has got a 300-page draft that's being delivered to members today, which is supposed to be highly critical of the agency, I think he felt that he had to sort of go public and defend himself and the people who work for him.
One of the most impassioned moments seemed to be when he said that we are nowhere near 85% finished in the search for WMDs. What did he seem to say about their existence?
Well, he sort of gave a report card, with, I think he wants to think of it as an interim report card, in which he admitted they hadn't found the weapons per se. What's interesting is he started off with missiles, which is the one place where they have sort of found things, but ironically, missiles were not the issue when the discussion took place about going to war. But I think he is waiting to find more things. He hopes to find more things, and he just doesn't want to close the door yet, but he admitted they hadn't found the weapons and had, in some cases, been misled by people who gave them human intelligence that turned out not to be true.
Walter, as you know, one of the biggest political questions is, was the CIA, you know, did they have bad intelligence or did the Bush administration ignore their caveats about their intelligence? Was that question answered today?
I don't think George Tenet, as a director, is going to say one way or the other. What he did make clear is, as you referred to in your opening, there was dissent. But in the speeches that were made by Vice President Cheney, the president himself, Condi Rice, the National Security Advisor, I don't think, particularly in the run-up to getting congressional approval for going to war, there was any idea that there were dissents.
Well, Walter, we'll be hearing more about this speech during the day. Thank you very much for joining us.
Right.
Walter Pincus, National Security Correspondent for The Washington Post.
Did a top Pakistani nuclear scientist try to sell nuclear technology to Saddam Hussein? In his speech at Georgetown University this morning, CIA Director George Tenet referred to Pakistani nuclear scientist Abdul Qadir Khan and his sales of nuclear secrets to Iran, Libya, and North Korea. Khan confessed to all that this week, and that has revived interest in his alleged connections to Iraq. Khan, the revered father of Pakistan's nuclear bomb, was pardoned this week by Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf. We're joined now from New Delhi by Scott Baldiff, reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. Hello, Scott.
Thank you.
Scott, what about these allegations about Khan and Iraq? UN weapons inspectors discovered in the late 1990s documents indicating a representative of Khan tried to sell nuclear weapons blueprints, possibly, and uranium enrichment equipment to Saddam Hussein.
Well, at this stage, it's really hard to know whether that evidence is accurate, if it's true, whether Khan's own representative or his subordinate visited Iraq, tried to sell weapons or weapons designs to Saddam Hussein. And in his own confession, none of the allegations about Iraq have been disclosed or admitted to. On the other hand, the actions do seem to fit a pattern. The AQ Khan Institute, the laboratory where many of these nuclear designs were turned into bombs and tested in 1998, many of those scientists at the Khan Institute did travel the world, particularly to Libya, North Korea, and to Iran, and attempted, and in some cases sold for millions of dollars, weapons designs, and in some cases actual equipment, including the very difficult-to-build centrifuges, which are used to enrich uranium.
How important was the information Khan and his colleagues gave Iran, Libya, and North Korea to those countries actually being able to create a nuclear bomb? And I say that reminding our listeners that North Korea is believed to have at least two bombs.
Well, what this technology allows these countries to do is in some ways slip beneath the radar of the international body, the International Atomic Energy Agency. To make a bomb out of plutonium, it's easier to notice that because plutonium is something that's very carefully watched. But uranium is something that is used in civilian programs as well. And so the movement of uranium, the counting of it, is a little bit more difficult for the UN agencies and for watchdogs to keep track of.
Scott, in his confession, his nationally televised confession to Pakistanis, Khan referred to the nation as traumatized. Is that your sense of it? He was a national hero.
Well, absolutely. Everywhere you go in Pakistan, there is going to be an institute, a school, a charity organization that's named after A.Q. Khan. It's not too much to say that this man is essentially their Albert Einstein. He's revered, and he also carries sort of a machismo of the ability of a developing country like Pakistan to create their own nuclear deterrent, particularly against their age-old enemy, India. So for Khan to be accused in this case of what is essentially corruption, of using his knowledge and selling it for personal gain, that's what he admits to doing, is a real comedown for a nation that really needed heroes.
How is this likely to affect U.S.-Pakistani relations? Certainly General Pervez Musharraf, president of Pakistan, did what the U.S. wanted him to do.
Well, thus far, the U.S. administration seems to be supportive of Musharraf. The question is whether they will want to want a further investigation into how high this goes, which of course would be very difficult for the military government of Pakistan.
Scott Baldoff, reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, joined us from New Delhi. Scott, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Meanwhile, attention also turns to Malaysia, where a company is under investigation for allegedly supplying nuclear parts to Libya's nuclear program. And that company is controlled by shareholder Kamaluddin Abdullah, the son of Malaysian Prime Minister Abdullah Badawi. The Malaysian government denies any nuclear links between the two countries, but both the CIA and Britain's intelligence agency, MI6, claim the company shipped centrifuge parts to Libya last October. Joining us on the line from Malaysia is BBC reporter Jonathan Kent. And Jonathan, many may remember the ship in question. It was stopped on its way to Libya. What is the charge regarding the Malaysian Prime Minister's son?
Kamaluddin Abdullah is one of three shareholders who between them own a majority in the company, which is believed to have made a number of the components found on board that ship, which was searched in Italy on its way to Libya. And the parts concerned can be used to make all sorts of things, from innocent pharmaceutical and oil industry applications to enriching uranium for nuclear weapons. Now, the boxes were found with the stamp of the Prime Minister's son's company on them, And subsequent to that, MI6 and the CIA got in touch with the Malaysian authorities. And we even had a visit here from John Bolton, the senior US official in charge of making sure that there is no weapons proliferation or nuclear proliferation around the world. And Malaysia has been busy denying that there are any links, that it has nuclear capabilities, but it's obviously sowing seeds of doubt in many people's minds.
The boxes, as you said, were labeled SCOPE, and that's a subsidiary of the SCOMI Group, am I pronouncing that correctly? Which, as you said, Kamaluddin has a huge interest in. They're also saying that, you know, why would we be sending nuclear materials if, in fact, we were stamping the name of our company all over the boxes?
That is a fair point. You would have thought they might have acted in a more clandestine manner. The Malaysians in their defence are saying that the deal was brokered by a Sri Lankan middleman. Interestingly, it's been reported that the Pakistani nuclear scientists at the centre of the controversy there visited Malaysia a number of times, including attending, allegedly, this middleman's wedding. Now, according to the Malaysians, the middleman never told the Malaysians what these parts were intended for.
Are you saying that there might be a link between the Malaysian delivery of these materials and the Pakistani nuclear scientist we've just spoken about, who is admitted to, you know, selling nuclear secrets to other countries?
At the minute, that is circumstantial, but there certainly appear, if the reports are accurate, to be personal links between the Pakistani nuclear scientist and the man from Sri Lanka who is alleged to have brokered the deal between the Libyans and the Malaysians.
Well, if there's anything to this personal relationship, it goes to show how enmeshed this world of nuclear weapons potentially is. How are the charges in Malaysia reverberating there and around the world?
It's actually attracting a lot of interest around the world, but in Malaysia, when the country's police chief spoke about this late yesterday, he went through the charges. He said, we found out this, we found out the country this and that, we found that the country doesn't have the ability to produce complete technology which is of use in a weapons program, but he didn't mention that the company under investigation was linked to the Prime Minister's son. And today, despite the fact that the Prime Minister himself has now spoken out and said, I want the police to investigate without fear or favour, that hasn't been reported here. It's only on the international services, the wire services. So I think there's an element they don't really want to let the cat out of the bag about the possible link here. Partly because there's an election on the horizon, and the Prime Minister has very much built his reputation on being Mr. Clean.
Well, Jonathan, thank you so much.
You are very welcome.
Reporter Jonathan Kent with the BBC in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia.
Just ahead, Boston's Museum of Fine Arts takes some of its exquisite collection on the road to Las Vegas.
And later, it's Grammy time. We'll listen to some of the many nominees.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
In a move that is reverberating throughout the fine art world, the nonprofit Museum of Fine Arts in Boston has struck a deal with the for-profit Bellagio Gallery of Fine Art in Las Vegas for a reported $1 million. The MFA agreed to rent more than half of its famed Monet collection to the gallery, which is housed in one of the grandest casinos in Las Vegas. Critics are worried this could be the start of a dangerous precedent that crosses the line between art and money. The museum says it's bringing art to the masses. Well, Malcolm Rogers is the director of Boston's Museum of Fine Arts. He joins us on the line from Las Vegas. Hello.
Hello.
Well, as you know, critics are being very critical of this move. Christopher Knight is an art critic of the LA Times. He says that the MFA should be ashamed for selling out to private interests. What's your response to that?
I obviously don't accept those remarks. I think what we're doing at the museum is a very sensible course to take. It allows art that perhaps might be in store at the museum to be seen in another city by a national and international audience. And it does also generate a revenue stream for one of the world's largest, if not the largest, privately funded museums.
Is the $1 million number the correct one?
It is speculative.
Well, I know, sir, you've just arrived in Las Vegas. Tell us about this display. I mean, what is it that we're talking about? What paintings are there?
The exhibition goes from the most wonderful, two of the most wonderful of Monet's snow scenes, right up to a late painting of water lilies, and one of the most beautiful water lilies. There's also the very famous portrait of Madame Monet with her son seated in the garden with beautiful, colorful flowers behind them. So there are some of the most exquisite of his works in the show. And very interestingly, from my point of view, well, two key things. First of all, the audio guide, which is a very intelligent guide to the exhibition, is in four languages. It's in English, French, Spanish, and I think it's also in Japanese, which tells me something about the people who are seeing the exhibition. The other thing I noticed is that both public and private school groups from the whole area around Las Vegas are beginning to book for the exhibition and coming. So it's obviously seen as an educational opportunity as well as a wonderful art recreational opportunity.
Well, that, as you know, is important because some of the criticism, and back to that, is that there are strict guidelines for how nonprofit museums lend out their paintings, and it's usually lend, not, you know, rent for a fee. There's usually an exchange with another not-for-profit museum. And in the book of guidelines from the Association of Art Museum Directors, it's stressed that any decision to loan from a collection has to have intellectual merit and educational benefits, as well as, of course, protect these works. So you feel it's having the educational benefits?
Of course it has educational benefits. And anybody who's been to Las Vegas knows that the audience here is an educated and affluent audience, not necessarily from parts of the country where there are great collections of art or Monet to see, and this is a real opportunity for them. I'd also say the arrangement is not as rare as Mr. Knight might lead you to believe. American museums and British museums, for instance, have for years been sending exhibitions of high-quality art to department stores in Japan.
Well, what about the other thinking? You mentioned it, you alluded to it before. It might be sort of an elitist thinking, but you know, there's a concern that you're going to have a beautiful Monet next to a velvet Elvis. Is this a real gallery setting?
It is a real gallery setting. And as I say, it's beautifully done. The gallery is not large, but the paintings are just in the perfect space, and the whole installation has a kind of jewel-like intensity, and there is nothing vulgar about the installation at all. It's exquisite, beautifully installed, beautifully lit.
Mm. Malcolm, you have come to the Museum of Fine Arts here in Boston and made many attempts to rejuvenate it. Everyone knows that museums across the country are having financial issues, and you have a car collection of fashion designer Ralph Lauren on the way. I remember your exhibit of guitars, the art of the guitar, photographs of Herb Ritts. And there are some people who wonder, are these the kinds of things, these pop culture things that belong in museums? Are you maybe trying too hard to bring the masses to something that should be fine art?
Well, I do believe that a great deal of what's in fine art museums was once popular culture. For instance, a great many of the ceramic treasures in the collection. Classically, Greek vases were pop culture of their day. And so the idea of the difference between high culture and pop culture is something that history makes nonsense of. But I also believe that one should look at objects that one takes for granted, like the guitar or a car, and explain to people why, within these objects, there's extraordinary design and beauty. So I'm trying to get away from the sort of hidebound conventions of what's acceptable and make people look afresh and try to use their brains a little and be less prejudiced.
You mentioned that other museums around the world have done this, rented out great works of art, if you will. But do you worry that this is a slippery slope, that, you know, really cash-strapped museums might start selling these pieces that really belong to the public to the highest price?
No, I don't believe that's the case. I think most museums are driven by a passion to have their works of art seen around the world. And it is wonderful if there is the opportunity to draw a stream of income from this. As I say, it's been the tradition absolutely in sending exhibitions to department stores in Japan for years, which many of the major museums have done. We've done that, and we've also generated for a fee exhibitions for many American museums, well-known American museums, who totally have been our partners on this. So there are lots of precedents, and you have to face the fact that museums have substantial overheads, very substantial overheads. We employ getting on for 1,000 people at the museum in Boston, and sources of income are important to us.
Well, Malcolm Rogers, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, well, thank you. If you want, I had quite a nice anecdote. Would you like that?
Sure, fire away.
When I arrived in Las Vegas, I was told immediately how on the television and radio stations here, there's been some indignation about the controversy about the Monets coming to Las Vegas, as if Las Vegas wasn't a worthy place. And I'm told that even the weatherman in his broadcast one morning said, "Who are these museum snobs who say we don't deserve Monet in Las Vegas?" I think that's a tremendous story.
Malcolm, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
And viva Monet.
Viva Monet.
Malcolm Rogers, director of the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. He spoke to us from Las Vegas. The exhibit, Claude Monet, Masterworks from the Museum of Fine Arts, is now on display at the Bellagio Gallery of Fine Art. For more information, check out our website, here-now.org.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
A term, activist judges, is being thrown around in the wake of yesterday's Massachusetts Supreme Court ruling clearing the way for gay marriage in the state. It's not meant as a compliment. Here's White House spokesperson Scott McClellan speaking for President Bush.
He talked about activist judges beginning to redefine marriage without regard for the will of the people. And he believes it's a issue of great consequence.
But what is an activist judge? We turn now to Boston College Professor of Constitutional Law, Charles Barron. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you very much. Thanks for asking me. Well, it could mean at least three things that I think could be meaningful. It could mean a judge who strikes down a lot of laws passed by legislatures. Interestingly, it's the kind of claim that can be made of courts that are considered to be conservative. For example, the conservative majority of the present Supreme Court probably has established a record in the past 20 years in terms of the number of laws passed by the Congress of the United States that it has struck down as unconstitutional. If this is what it means, it's the kind of thing that can be established objectively. Just look at the record and see how many laws have been stricken. A second thing that it could mean is a court that goes out of its way to take on controversial issues that it could avoid taking on. Ironically, the Supreme Court probably showed itself to be activist to a great extent in these terms, taking on Bush versus Gore. The third thing, which is I think the critical thing that could be meant by an activist judge, is a judge who writes an opinion in deciding a case that when you read it over closely, it doesn't really wash in terms of trying to convince the reader that the decision is justified on the basis of precedent that has developed over years. Much of the great law that we take for granted, including constitutional principles, were first developed by judges in specific cases. And the vague language of our written Constitution, phrases like due process of law, equal protection of the law, they really contemplate that judges will continue this process. So whether or not the SJC has been activist really ought to be judged on the basis of reading the opinions.
Is it clear as a bell when a judge is an activist judge and when a judge is not an activist judge?
Certainly not by this third standard, which I think is the most important standard. There are many people who, by this standard, again, would consider the present conservative majority of the Supreme Court as activist. And certainly as activist as the Warren Court, which was considered to be the heroes of the liberals in this country. But the difference is the direction in which this court is taking us. Instead of the Warren Court, which took us in the direction of increasing protection under the Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment, the Rehnquist Court has been activist in protecting states' rights and increasing the power of the Supreme Court itself.
Won't any judge or collection of judges bring their own human prejudices to any given decision?
I think, obviously, they're bringing their own perspectives and, to some extent, their own values. But that is not principally what's being applied. I think the values they bring to their decisions are a function of a process of dialogue and argument among the judges themselves, the participation of advocates who appear before the court, and the values that they find in prior decisions of other judges.
Certainly one man's or woman's activist judge is another man or woman's straight down the line by the numbers judge, right?
I think that's right, but it would be nice if that wasn't always determined by how people feel about the result or whether they consider themselves a liberal or conservative. I'd like to think that it would be possible for liberals and conservatives to agree sometimes that even if they like the result, this judge has been too activist. Or even if they don't like the result, judges have not been activist enough.
Let's shift back, Professor, to the actual Massachusetts Supreme Court decision itself. There's some language in it that some people are saying not only legalizes gay marriage, but also all kinds of marriages involving incest and polygamy between adults and minors. What do you think about that?
I can't imagine that that's what the court is suggesting. We're not going to find out until we bring another case before the court and give it an opportunity to interpret that language on the facts of another case. Those situations will have to be judged on their own facts.
Thank you, Professor. Charles Barron is a professor of constitutional law at Boston College. He spoke to us in Boston.
We turn now to Karen Malmy. You may have heard Karen before. She's an occasional contributor to Here and Now, and she was profiled yesterday in the Boston Globe because Karen and her partner Meg Stone have set a date for their union. They're making plans and all the arrangements. The only thing that seemed to be missing was what to call it. And Karen joins us on the line. Karen, what are you calling it now?
Oh, we're calling it a full-fledged wedding.
Yeah.
We're going all the way.
Were you going to do it anyway if it was a reduced to, let's say, a civil union?
The funny thing is we had been planning our wedding a lot longer than the SJC was planning their – well, actually, they were planning longer, but we were planning our wedding before that decision ever came around.
Right.
So when we heard the decision, it just got us all the more excited to just plunge right in and get our plans going.
What was your reaction when the decision came down yesterday that, in fact, it would have to be – that the state has to provide marriages?
It's incredible. We're still kind of absorbing the fact that it is a marriage. I mean, I've waited all my life to hear those validating words that my life and our lives as gays and lesbians is something to be celebrated, not something to be feared or hated, discriminated against. We are just as loving, just as committed, just as caring and nurturing of each other in our relationships as anybody else. And to be able to fully celebrate that legally is just a wonderful thing. I mean, there's like 1,400 rights and privileges that heterosexual married couples have.
What are some of those that you're, you know, obviously going to have now that you wouldn't have had before and that you wouldn't have in a civil union?
The things that I'm concerned about are basically the fact that if something were to happen to Meg or myself, we'd be hospitalized for a lengthy period of time, or one of us dies or something like that, that there would be nothing we could really do. It's your responsibility to make decisions based upon their welfare, and if there's nothing on paper that says you can do that, that's a very frightening and real reality that many gays and lesbian couples face. Mm-hmm. And to now have some of those rights is incredible.
Yeah. I know you joked a lot in the article about, you know, what exactly is going to go on the top of the cake. And I mean, what do you wear?
Yeah.
I mean, are there things that you're suddenly now confronted with, like, wow, this is real, and I got to think about this.
Yeah, well, it's been real for us. Whether it's been real. Mm-hmm. Our love and our commitment to each other is just as real as anything.
Karen Malmy, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Karen spoke to us on the line from Boston, Massachusetts.
Still to come, handicapping the Grammy Awards.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
Our segment on whether or not President Bush was AWOL, absent without leave, when he was in the National Guard, drew many responses. Michael McCord of Dover, New Hampshire, wrote, "The White House may reject what they call political smear tactics about this issue, but for many Vietnam-era veterans such as myself, it matters. At best, Bush omitted the truth. At worst, during his run for the presidency, Bush lied. It cuts to the heart of Bush's credibility as commander-in-chief, who possibly misled the country about the Iraq War."
Laura Slid of Bartlett, New Hampshire, also wrote, "Following our interview with Dr. Lester Crawford, Deputy Commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, about new changes in rules concerning cattle feed in light of the recent mad cow case," Laura writes, "Thank you for asking the right questions about animal feeding loopholes. I'm astounded that an FDA official would not be concerned about feeding rendered pigs/chickens to cows when those chickens have been fed rendered and possibly diseased cow parts."
Well, we received a lot of response to our segment on the baring of Janet Jackson's breast during the Super Bowl halftime show. Sam Copper of Hingham, Massachusetts, writes, "Janet's breast baring is not the whole or even the main issue. The whole freaking halftime show is what was so outrageous. The FCC and the Congress have caused this problem. Deregulation of broadcasting has centered the power in a few hyper-capitalistic mega-corporations. It is utterly absurd for the FCC at all to come off as incensed by a televised breast when the marketplace that dominates the broadcast media has degenerated into formulaic gutter slush."
Our interview with Murad Kalam, an American Muslim who made the pilgrimage to Mecca, the Hajj, one of the five pillars of the Islamic faith, prompted this call on our listener line from Bob McCormick of Foxborough, Massachusetts.
Robin's question to her interviewee was, how difficult was it to come back to the sinful United States, and how are you dealing with that? And I was just taken aback by that. I think people are people, and societies are societies, and nobody's got a monopoly on that sort of higher moral behavior.
And finally, Jeremy Withers had a musical question. "I've given up on commercial radio completely," he says, "so it's always great to hear snippets of music I love between your stories. But now you've got me stumped. I liked a song you played recently which sounded like the band Ganger. What is it?" Well, Jeremy, the band is Euphone, and the song is Two Basic Colors off the album Euphone.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember, include your full name, your phone number, and town.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Fallout from the fallout of Janet Jackson's breast continues. Reports are that Jackson will not be a presenter on this Sunday's telecast of the Grammy Awards. Justin Timberlake, the fellow who actually ripped her clothing off, is still scheduled to appear. CBS says it will be using a delay on both audio and video broadcasts to prevent any more malfunctions. And oh yes, there will be awards. Atlanta hip-hop duo OutKast. Their release, Speaker Box, The Love Below, is up for 6 Grammys, including Record of the Year and Album of the Year. But remind me, what is the difference? And why are there so many, over 100 categories? Well, joining us in the studio to talk Grammys here now, pop music critic Tim Riley. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Robin.
And we're also joined by Renee Graham, pop culture critic for the Boston Globe, as well as one of Here Now's film reviewers. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Robin.
So, Tim, with so many categories, why are there so many multiple awards?
Well, they're trying to acknowledge all the different, the range of styles that are out there that they seem to have identified markets for, but it's a very ignorant voting body in terms of having the range and the knowledge of all of those styles. So they wind up voting for the same person over and over again across several different categories, and so you get all these multiple nominees.
Right. Renee, remind us, who votes?
The people who vote are members of the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences, musicians, producers, people in the industry. But, you know, Tim makes a good point. When you have that many categories, people just don't know who a lot of these artists are who are being nominated. So, yeah, they keep voting for the same people. They vote for the names they recognize.
The cover of People magazine gets voted for a lot.
Yeah.
And, Tim, I know that there's a lot of people who will not be staying up late for those big awards at the end of the night because they've never heard of these acts.
Well, it's definitely targeted to what they say. It skews to a younger demographic. And so, you know, the kids are going to be the ones who stay up later to see who wins the big awards. There's not a lot of tension.
We could all remember back to, you know, when they gave out, I think, one of the first awards they gave out for heavy metal, and they gave it to Jethro Tull instead of Metallica, the year Metallica, I think, put out the Black Album. You know, so now they're going, like, bending backwards and bending over double, trying to seem relevant. But really all they're doing is appealing to, you know, the sort of MTV Total Request Live crowd. So that's why you have, you know, someone like Justin Timberlake nominated for Album of the Year and a group like Evanescence. It's, you know, I don't have a problem with the White Stripes or OutKast or even Missy Elliott, even though I don't think it's her best album. But when you see Justin Timberlake in there, you know that's about, you know, getting younger viewers and getting ratings. Now it's your turn to
cry. He also appears in the Record of the Year category, along with one of my favorite groups, Coldplay. Confusion never stops. Closing walls and ticking clocks. Gonna come back and take you home. I could not stop, but you now know. Singing, come out. Also in Record of the Year, Beyonce, the Black Eyed Peas, and as we said, Justin Timberlake, Eminem, and OutKast. What's the difference between Record of the Year and Album of the Year?
Oh, would someone please explain it to me? Record of the Year is whether you made the best song and then produced it really well and you made a great track. And if that track appears on a great album that's also nominated for Album of the Year, then you're just extra super special lucky.
And
but
then
you
song
could
of the
win
year.
For Record of the Year, or you could win for Song of the Year. So right. Song of the Year apparently is, if it's a really great song but the production is crappy, we'll give you Song of the Year.
Right.
But of course, those distinctions are really lost on everybody.
And Song of the Year is also, it's a songwriter's award. It goes to the songwriter.
Yeah. In the Song of the Year categories, there's Beautiful by Linda Perry. Christina Aguilera recorded it. Dance with My Father, Richard Marx and Luther Vandross. I'm With You, Avril Lavigne and The Matrix. Songwriter Avril Lavigne. And then Keep Me in Your Heart, Jorge Calderon and the late Warren Zevon. Isn't that a shoo-in?
You'd think, but I would have thought his album The Wind would have been a shoo-in for Album of the Year, but you never know with these things.
Because, of course, he passed away and was dying when he recorded this album.
Exactly. If I leave you, it doesn't mean I love you any less. Keep me in your heart for a while. When you get up in the morning and you see that crazy sun, keep me in your heart for a while. Another interesting choice with Song of the Year is Lose Yourself by Eminem. Eminem has 5 nominations. He didn't release an album in 2003. You know, the Academy loves Eminem. And even though he didn't release the album, Lose Yourself came from the soundtrack for 8 Mile. One shot, do not miss your chance to blow. This opportunity comes once in a lifetime. Your soul's escaping through this hole that is gaping. This world is mine. The movie came out in 2002. The song already won an Oscar for Best Song last year. So it's just, I mean, I think he's going to do really well, even though he didn't release an album. I think
Well, and that's another case of the Grammys trying to say, you know, look, if the Oscars named it Song of the Year, then we sort of have to put it on our list this year, don't you think? We'll look silly if we don't. And they look even sillier because it's a year behind. They're always doing this stuff. For instance, they left out the Strokes album. And that's what everyone's talking about, that record. It came out in October. But apparently it's too late to get on the list this year. So it'll be on next year.
Because the cutoff is something like, isn't September 30th or something?
It's a crazy cutoff, and nobody can keep track of it. It doesn't make any sense. There's a lot of other shutouts this year that are worth talking about. Steely Dan, Everything Must Go. And some people say, well, it's not as good a record as the previous record, which won Grammy, Two Against Nature, which won the big awards a couple years ago. So all of a sudden, Steely Dan are on the outs. There's no really good reason for it. It's a beautifully produced record. There's a lot of good songs on it, a lot of good playing on it. They could have given, like, Saxophone Player of the Year or something. It's very inconsistent. You can't keep all these awards on Steely Dan one year, and then the next year, the next album gets absolutely nothing.
But I think the Grammys were... There was a little bit of show that went through the Grammys when Steely Dan won that year, because a lot of people thought that Eminem should have won for the Marshall Mathers LP. So I think this year they went in the opposite direction. There are no Greybeards this year. There's no Sting for Album of the Year.
Yeah.
There's no Bob Dylan.
No,
there's no Paul Simon.
Although,
now they've gone the other way.
Although those guys fit in this, one of my favorite categories, Best Pop Collaboration with Vocals While Wearing Socks. I added the socks part because they just seem to go out of their way to do this, to lasso in Sting and Mary J. Blige, or Bob Dylan who joins Mavis Staples, Tony Bennett and K.D. Lang.
We heard any of these songs?
But in other words, it's almost as if someone said, we have to get some of these guys in. How can we do it? Let's have this category. Whenever those dark clouds hide the moon, whenever this world has gotten so strange, something's gonna fly. Whenever I said what you missed. What surprised you? What'd you like?
Well, I was very happy to see the Dave Holland Jazz Quintet show up for one nomination anyway for a brilliant double record, live record called Extended Play. I was also happy to see the Yeah 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 show up, Best Alternative, alongside the White Stripes for Best Alternative.
And if I can throw in something, Best Alternative, I was also really happy to see the Flaming Lips get a nomination for an EP, Fight Test. If it's on now, then tell me when would be the time she would stand up and be a man. For to lose I could accept, but to surrender I just wept and regretted this moment. Oh, that I don't know.
Can I just say, even though this isn't why people are tuning in, but I was personally really happy to see Ned Wurm's 3 symphonies as played by the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra nominated.
Well, you may jest, but actually I think the larger point is that the classical nominations are all pretty solid, and as far as I'm concerned. Non-rock producer Manfred Eicher is nominated. He did a ton of great production work last year. All of his records on ECM are beautifully produced and beautiful-sounding products, and the classical end of this thing actually holds up pretty well.
But people will tune in to see Justin Timberlake sing Cry Me a River.
go figure.
That's it.
I want to thank you both.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
Here now, pop music critic Tim Riley and film critic Renee Graham, who also covers pop culture for the Boston Globe. For the very long list of the Grammy nominations, go to our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa, Brad Fritz, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild's our engineer. He's assisted by Matt Odette. Our web producer is Zach Christo. Our intern is Ed Walters.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.